listening to Mystic Lounge with Alan B. Smith. Rebroadcast on the Onyx Network, Thursdays at 11 p.m. Pacific, Fridays at 2 a.m. Eastern.
However you are and whenever you are, welcome to Mystic Lounge. This is Alan B. Smith. Join us as we take a sojourn in between time and space with none other than the one and only Daniel Pinchbeck. And I'm just beyond stoked to have Daniel on today. He's the author of Breaking Open the Head. And, you know, for me, that was a groundbreaking work. And in fact, I had barely been introduced to the literature of psychedelics when this book was released. And it was definitely a, in its own right, a consciousness shifter. So I really do appreciate where we've gone over the past, you know, 15 plus years with the dialogue of psychedelics. As you know, on this program, I bring up on occasion, and Daniel has written many other books as well. I'll go over that in just a minute. Before we get started tonight, as a friendly reminder, if you want to use my drug of choice to get that sort of transcendent kick, please check out aliencoffeebean.com for their delicious roasts, and be sure to enter the discount code MYSTERY20. That's all caps MYSTERY20 for 20% off in the U.S. shipping only. It's aliencoffeebean.com, and I have it right here. If you're a fan of this program, please subscribe on the YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/mysticlounge. On social media, Twitter's at underscore paranormal now, and on Instagram at paranormal now. Daniel Pinchbeck is a philosopher and author, and to my mind, a psychedelic eco-futurist. Daniel is the author of Breaking Open the Head, 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, Notes from the Edge of Times, How Soon Is Now, and the co-author of the book When Plants Dream with Sophia Rocklin. In 2007, he launched the web magazine Reality Sandwich and co-founded Evolver.net. Daniel hosted a talk show, Mindshift, on Gaiam TV, exploring the evolution of technology and spirituality and our potential for the future. He has been a speaker at conferences around the world and co-hosted retreats to Costa Rica with the Sequoia tribal people from the Amazon and Ecuador, and Colombia with the Kogi and Arawak people. His life and work were featured in the 2010 documentary, 2012, Time for Change. He has been accused of participatory journalism and challenging the status quo. Daniel, welcome to Paranormal Now, a Mystic Lounge. I went with my old title, excuse me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining. I just said Paranormal Now because recently we just changed the show to Mystic Lounge because I'm taking it in a completely different direction. And much of that has to do with, you know, my desire to understand consciousness a little bit better. You know, I come from the background of dealing with, sometimes debilitating anxiety, depression, and addiction. And I've come a long way. Part of my early journey was experimenting with psychedelics, but I don't attribute where I am now to my recovery. However, those experiences that I had then do play an important part in my spiritual life now. So for those who may not be familiar with your work, Daniel, could you tell us a little bit about the beginning of your journey into psychedelic research?
I took psychedelics a handful of times when I was in college at Wesleyan. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of forgot about them. And then in my sort of mid to late 20s, I sort of started to have like a existential despair. And I'd grown up as a sort of secular materialist. My parents were artists, but they didn't have any like religious beliefs. And the sort of prevailing paradigm was materialism, which is the idea that consciousness is entirely based in the brain. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when we croak, that's it. There's no possibility of any continuity of spirit or self or soul. So I wanted to interrogate that and see if that was really the case. And I remembered my psychedelic experiences from college as being the most intriguing kind of access points to maybe some other types of consciousness or other types mm-hmm. of dimensions or whatever. So then I was a journalist working for different magazines. So I was able to get some assignments. So I went to Gabon in Africa, where they have a psychedelic called Iboga, sometimes known in the West as Ibogaine, which is like mm-hmm. the longest lasting psychedelic. So I went through a Iboga initiation with the Bwiti tribe in Gabon. Then I also visited the Mazatec Indians, worked with psilocybin mushrooms, Oaxaca, and stayed with the Sequoia community, as you mentioned, in Ecuador, who have an ancient ayahuasca tradition. And that ended up being the basis for the first book. And along the way, I had all sorts of paranormal and mystical and transpersonal and synchronistic and telepathic and telekinetic, crazy types of experiences, which ultimately profoundly shifted my worldview mm-hmm. to something that's more Jungian or shamanic. At this point, I'm very sort of taken with the ideas of analytic idealism from Bernardo Kastrup, the author of a book called Why Materialism is Baloney. And so that's kind of that's how I got into it.
Yeah. When you say paranormal or like psychic kind of experiences, I do recall having a couple of those where it was like we were reading each other's mind. It was almost instant, it felt like. Is that the kind of experience that you had with someone
sure,
else?
Sure, I mean, many kinds. I mean, one of the first ones that I write about is, with the Iboga, sort of seeing the sort of wooden statue walk across the room and mm-hmm. afterwards describing it to the shamans. They were like, oh yeah, of course, that's the spirit of Iboga that comes out at the beginning to talk to you. Mm-hmm. But then also one of the shamans telling me that he could see the spirit of my mother's mother hovering over me, that he saw that she had died very recently and she was protecting me and didn't want me to see certain things in the spirit world. And it was true that she just died in the last year or so, and nobody there knew that. I hadn't talked to anybody about my life or whatever. So just over time, it became more and more obvious that there was kind of a, transpersonal domains of, telepathic information. And just like many, many things happened that just continue to reinforce that and support that, which I describe in the Breaking Open the Head, but also in the 2012 book.
Yeah. And there's also this kind of trickster aspect, which we can get into a little bit, but I do wonder. So I had at one point taken a lower dose of psilocybin mushrooms, and I was by myself, and I was listening to something on an iPod. It's like, semi early 2000s. And I'm looking at the screen, and on the screen, no matter what music I played, this Alice in Wonderland trippy song kept playing. And it was, I thought, this is really bizarre. It's never happened before. I grabbed a camera. I recorded it on camera, sober enough to do that, so that I can be like, oh my God, this thing is actually real. That camera got lost, unfortunately. And, that sort of evidence of a bizarre occurrence is no longer. I do wonder sometimes, because materialism desires it more so, I suppose, the materialist scientist. But I think we desire being able to present some sort of evidence that these altered states of consciousness do tap into some other, parallel reality or dimension, and that these strange occurrences are real and not just something that is a hallucinatory experience in our mind. Is that something that's occurred to you, where you've tried to kind of put your thumb on it and say, aha, I've got the evidence for it, and it slipped between your fingers?
I mean, actually, I have one example right here, which is not that easy to mm-hmm. see, but and the problem with a lot of things that are, psychic and paranormal is they sort of become very flimsy if you write about them or even talk about them. Mm-hmm. So what feels subjective is like very totally convincing evidence often feels less convincing, when you talk about it a lot. But this was when I wrote the 2012 book, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl is like the Feathered Serpent. Mm-hmm. I turned in the book and the editor rejected it. He said I had to totally rewrite it. He was right. The book just wasn't ready yet. But I was overwhelmed. It just seemed like impossible. And I did a small ayahuasca session in my house with two friends where we just drank the medicine together and listened to music. And it was pretty early in the evening. And the whole night I was thinking about, the Feathered Serpent, Quetzalcoatl. Also, ayahuasca is known as the Cosmic Serpent. When we came down from the ayahuasca, we were still in a good mood. So we actually went down the block where there was a sake bar. They went in to order sake. I stayed outside to smoke a cigarette. And there was a tree, and I saw where the tree bifurcated. There was this little metal thing sticking up. And I pulled it up, and I don't know if you can see it very well. Yeah. But it was this crazy pen from, I don't know, when the turn of the century or something, in the shape of a cobra, in the shape of a snake. And I pulled it right out of the tree, and it really seemed to be like a direct kind of like, I had writer's block, and the spirits were saying, here's your pen, get back to work. It was in the shape of a serpent. I'd been thinking about the cosmic serpent and the feathered serpent. So it was a very overdetermined and very legitimate for me message from these other worlds. Nothing like that has ever happened. And the pen is totally unusual. It's made of like a heavy metal, like pewter. And I've never seen anything like it before.
Were you actually able to date it, or do you have no idea?
What's that?
Were you actually able to date when that pen was?
The pen has, I think it has, what is it? It may have sort of wiped away by now, but it used to have, what does it say on it? I could check it out. It has initials, CCB. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I mean, whatever. It's just a crazy, and that was the most tangible, but all sorts of other things that were, to me, were equally tangible. They just didn't, leave as much of a big trace,
Yeah. Do you think that when you are, engaged with the psychedelic, whether it be DMT, ayahuasca, yahe, marijuana. I mean, it doesn't, not that that's psychedelic, but any kind of, mind altering substance that kind of shifts your state. Do you think that synchronicities occur more frequently when you're kind of tuned in?
They seem to occur more frequently. I think that people go through, when you're, kind of exploring this material, you go through kind of like a kind of initiatory process. Mm-hmm. And during that time, you're kind of like amping up your sort of frequency in a way. And the world kind of, gives you all sorts of messages in that process. Yeah. And you have to be careful because they're not always healthy. Like, you can get negative synchronicities too. I mean, or paths that you shouldn't explore, So you have to be careful because as the field of your psyche becomes amplified and more powerful, all the things that you haven't reckoned with in your shadow or your subconscious also become amplified and more powerful.
So it's a tool, it's an amplifier. Ayahuasca, I mean, you focused an entire book on this brew. Is the natural substance more potent and therapeutic uses versus the DMT, which is, seems to be more visionary and world exploring?
Well, I mean, DMT is often natural also. I mean, it comes from natural sources.
Well, that's true. Yeah. And we produce it in our head. Right?
But I mean, so I think you're talking about the difference between drinking ayahuasca and smoking DMT. Mm-hmm. There's two types of DMT. DMT stands for dimethyltryptamine. It's a very interesting compound because we actually produce it in our bodies. DMT, the spirit molecule by Rick Strassman, was one of the big books for kind of rethinking DMT. He was one of the first people to get sort of money from, he was able to do a study with human subjects with DMT. He ended up with a thesis that it may be secreted by the pineal gland, and it may actually be a sort of chemical compound that, connects the soul to these other worlds at birth and at death and so on. When you smoke high dose DMT, it's a much faster, more overwhelming, and sort of less organic feeling. It's like going into like a super futuristic other world. With the NN-DMT. With the 5-MeO-DMT, it's more like the direct experience of non-duality or the void or nirvana, as Buddhism talks about it. Mm-hmm. So that's a very different kind of experience. The ayahuasca potion actually contains both of those substances.
Yeah, and when plants dream, you discuss this topic of the idea that perhaps ayahuasca is not a millennium old tradition, and that it's something rather new. And because of that, does that remove the sort of appropriation guilt that Westerners often have with embracing these indigenous cultural rituals and drugs?
Right. Well, yeah, we don't know about ayahuasca. I mean, there's different evidence. I mean, I think the jury's still out on that. I mean, we definitely know that at least the ayahuasca vine by itself, which is psychoactive, was mm-hmm. used for quite a long time. We don't know necessarily that it was used in combination with the DMT plant, but it very well may have been. Different kind of correlates of that kind of chemical compound may have also been used in the Middle East and so on. Mm-hmm. I mean, Syrian rue and Mosa hostilis are Middle Eastern plants that produce a similar effect, or acacia also has DMT. There's a theory that the burning bush of Moses was probably an acacia bush, and therefore he was actually ingesting DMT when he had his the meetings with God and so on.
Divine experience.
I warned you, I just want to interrupt.
That's right. It's a call from the spirit world. They have something to share with us. We'll find out in just a moment. If you have any questions for Daniel, please drop them in the chat. I'd really like to hear what you have to say. And on top of that, if you have had an experience with psychedelic use, I wonder, did that benefit you in any way regarding recovery and wellness? And did you have a good experience? Or did you walk away from your psychedelic use with a positive impression? So, Daniel, in most cases, when you discuss, because you discuss this all the time, psychedelic use with other users, is it a positive experience? And by that, I don't mean a heavy introspective look at one's psyche, but a healthy usage versus a traumatic, terrifying experience.
Oh yeah, overwhelmingly people tend to have very positive experiences and feel that it mm-hmm. Has benefits for their life in many ways. But they're also, it's a very powerful, they're very powerful tools, and there's also a whole list of potential negative consequences mm-hmm. from the subtle to the wrenching, that can happen.
Yeah, if you were to start your journey again now, as opposed to, I think when's your first book come out? 2004, right?
2002.
2002, yeah. So if you were to redo that journey, start now, would you do it now?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, of course. All right.
Yeah. So I would do it harder.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain amount of discomfort, I think, that comes with this exploration. I think that the experience of the shock and experience, like I've had a really bad trip before that I wish on no one. It was that bad. Almost put someone else in harm's way, put myself in harm's way. Coming out of those darker trips, I do feel that there is growth. And to go back to the original book, Breaking Open the Head, it's like it's like cracking open the psyche and going, holy crap. There's a lot of stuff that I need to deal with. So you started this back in 2002, when the book came out. After all these years, how have you benefited? How have you benefited for trying all these different types of psychedelic substances? Have you grown?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a long and complicated story. I mean, I definitely feel there were tremendous benefits in terms of, now we're seeing Imperial College has been doing all these brain scans of people on high dose psychedelics. So you can actually see what the potential benefits are, because you see these mm-hmm. various areas of the brain that are normally dormant kind of light up and new patterns, pathways of connection forming between them. So that would really, add to the theory that they're really good for cognitive flexibility.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, like, isn't it positive for Alzheimer's? I think, right? That there's some possible benefit to reducing the possible, onset.
Yeah.
Or,
yeah. It could be. I mean, I don't know if that's been fully established yet, but I mean, so yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, I had a bunch of things that were hanging over me when I was younger, like OCD, some form of OCD, a little bit depression, to some extent. I cleared some of that with psychedelics. However, later on, I think that everybody has a different journey, but my shadow material also got sort of activated, catalyzed by psychedelics. You know, it was sort of like I became kind of like famous in the scene, and people, you know, I was sort of, I mean, I was sort of expected that I would, you know, be a certain thing or something. And I think, you know, my ego got caught up in that, and, you know, I sort of made mistakes in how I, you know, so I mean, my story is long and complicated, but I think in general that, you know, people benefit from it. But they're also, as you know, but things that we're going to become more sophisticated as a society in how we make use of this, and we'll begin to understand more and more about the problems, the dangers that can happen. I mean, like one common danger is can be like ego inflation, you know, can people feeling like, you know, kind of a messianic sense of self-importance or something. Interpreting everything as a sign, becoming more impulsive, actually feeling that their consciousness is higher than others. I mean, you know, there are lots of problems that can result from psychedelics.
Yeah,
as well as them exacerbating like mental illness or even, you know, causing it mental illness.
Right, right. Well, that's the thing that's interesting, because we hear so much talk in the media as of late regarding the positive attributes of controlled therapy for PTSD, and you know, there's approval now to go through these trials, and that's fantastic. But does that mean that there is no danger in it? I had a kind of like a psychotic break when I was on that on mushrooms this one time, and certainly it has a lot to do with the dosage, how much you're taking. But there is a danger, and so it goes back to, I guess, to this Timothy Leary problem of is this the saving grace of humanity? And if so,
I don't think it's the saving grace of humanity, but I mean, I think it's the fact is, without psychedelics, we've gone insane as a species, right? Like, look what's happening, you know, look at the nuclear weapons everywhere, look at the, you know, incredible inequalities of capitalism, you know, look at the destruction of the ecosystems of the planet. So, you know, we clearly need, you know, some new clues as to how we move along, you know, from this point, if we can move along from this point. And, you know, I do think that there's a reason why, there's all this excitement about the psychedelic experience, you know, where sort of this new psychedelic renaissance, and the hope that, it can, you know, inspire people to be more connected to spirit, more connected to the planet, see things differently, you know, and all that stuff is really true, you know. So, but yeah, I mean, it's not a, you know, panacea. It's not like, you know, it's a tool, and like, it's a very they're very powerful tools, and all tools can have benefits and negatives, you know, going back to, you know, writing or fire or whatever your tool is, you know.
So if we legalize it, how do you envision we as a society integrate it healthily?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, you know, no worse than alcohol or tobacco. I mean, you know, we've normalized these things. I mean, if there was lounges, people could go and take like mushrooms and ketamine and MDMA together and snuggle and talk about their feelings, rather than just bars where people drink, you know, vodka and whatever. You know, I think that would be a huge evolutionary step, you know. And yeah, I mean, as I said, the more it becomes normalized, the more we'll learn about, you know, the dangers of it, and the more sophisticated people will be about it, you know. But, you know, some people will always mess up, just as some people will always get into car crashes, you know, get too drunk and get into car crashes or whatever. So, you know, you can't really, you know, we sort of live in this, you know, this concept of the nanny state right now. We're supposed to protect everybody from everything. And I don't think that's really, you know, possible or even healthy. You know, I mean, you know, one thing we could see in the future would be an understanding of initiation. That's actually been a big theme of my work. In every culture up until, you know, contemporary or modern, you know, technological civilization, there was an idea that young people were supposed to go through some training in visionary or transpersonal states that actually you couldn't really be fully an adult person in the community until you'd had these kind of visionary experiences and also had them kind of acknowledged by the elders, and the elders kind of like integrating, you know, bringing wisdom into those experiences. There was a whole process. Joseph Chilton Pierce is a writer. He wrote The Crack of the Cosmic Egg and also The Biology of Transcendence. And so he's one thinker who I think is very interesting. He talks about how we have an innate need for transcendent experience. You know, adolescents will push themselves past the limit because they're trying to bring about a visionary experience or visionary consciousness, even if they don't know what they're doing. And it's inbuilt in our neurological hardware. And so we live in a society that only allows people to have those experiences destructively, you know, through, you know, meth or heroin or violent video games or alcohol. Yeah. And so, you know, it would be much healthier for us to kind of, you know, reconnect with this concept of initiatory disciplines and practices.
Yeah.
So that, yes, that young people could get more understanding of themselves and also have more access to deeper levels of self-knowledge.
Yeah. Exploring oneself is so innate to adolescence. Everything is so new. Even yourself is new to you. So when you're limited to, at best, marijuana, but really alcohol is, you know, it's just ubiquitous and it's accepted and almost encouraged. Then yeah, you're on this journey of self exploration, and now you're using a drug that is not only suppressant to your soul. It gives you moments of joy, but you know, when you're trying to push the limits, when you push the limits of alcohol, it takes you to a really bad place. And I'm just speaking, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
more so probably than others out there. But you know, that was my experience. And of course, when I, you know, taking a psilocybin drug or an LSD, it wasn't addictive at all. I mean, ecstasy was like mildly so. It was kind of right on that edge, but not really. And I didn't go back to it like other harder drugs or alcohol, you know. Mm-hmm. So we have two general societal structures. So we've got, several, but okay. So dictatorship, you know, authoritarian, you've got communism and then capitalism. In the communist state, it's very rigid. It doesn't really allow for the flexibility that where the experimentation of consciousness can thrive. That can occur in capitalism, but capitalism is also greedy and hedonistic and all that. So to your mind, what's the best like governmental or sociological like substrate to where this lives best?
Oh, okay. That's an interesting turn of events, like a different type of question, a big question. There's so many layers to that, right? I mean, the problem is that my perspective is that, you know, capitalism is unsustainable because it forces constant growth. Like money is issued into existence as debt. Mm-hmm. So everybody has to, you know, try to make interest to fulfill the debt. So they have to keep growing. Corporations, publicly traded corporations, you know, who are in the stock market have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder value, which means that they constantly have to increase profit. And which means often evading environmental restrictions or, you know, doing things that aren't healthy for different types of individuals or communities or whatever. Sure. So I look at capitalism maybe as like a transitional stage for species like ourselves. Like in 3 centuries, we have, brought the whole world together into one system. We've created roads, satellites, you know, airplane routes, shipping routes, fiber optics, you know. So now we've almost created like one giant, like global apparatus. Mm-hmm. So the question is there another jump that we could take from this point? I mean, when you talk about Yeah, I mean, obviously, we look at the historical examples of communism in like Russia and China. They weren't very good. They were basically other forms of authoritarianism. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, Marx himself didn't think that communism would work in those types of societies. That was sort of neo-feudal. Mm-hmm. That communism in those societies was just a step from kind of feudalism to modernization, basically. And now they've become modern authoritarian or totalitarian societies. You know, we don't know if some more cooperative or symbiotic economic form might work in an evolved first world society. I mean, definitely if you go to like Scandinavia, you know, their countries are, you know, sort of neo-socialist, right? Like they have very good social services, people kind of look after each other, and they sort of cap the amount of excess wealth, and they have great, you know, kind of, you know, the cities are in great shape. I mean, you come to New York, I was on the JFK yesterday, and it's embarrassing. Like the infrastructure is so bad, even though this is theoretically the richest country in the world. And the reason for that being the case is that all the money is sucked to the top, you know, 0.1% who are lording it over us in their private jets. This is a crap system, basically, from my perspective. Mm-hmm. So, you know, probably those Scandinavian sort of neo-socialist systems are very interesting for us to look at. Mm-hmm. But then actually, if you go back further, you can look at indigenous cultures. Like, I mean, the American Constitution was based to a certain extent on the Iroquois Confederacy and the Iroquois Constitution. But they were very different than us. They gave women actually more political power than men in many respects. They were kind of ways that women could intervene politically. And then also they really were not for excessive wealth inequality. So wealth was pretty much equalized throughout society. And actually the male leaders, the captains or the chiefs, were often the ones who owned the least, because it was kind of a mark of their nobility of spirit that they would just circulate anything that they received. So it was much more of an idea of reciprocity or nobility or something. So this whole idea that we have a culture where we look up to people who've amassed, you know, huge amounts of wealth and resources is I think totally trashy in a way. Like that's not something to admire, you know.
Right. But these are things that occurred naturally within these societies and
No, they didn't occur naturally. It was a design problem. They went through, they probably went through many centuries of trial and error. I mean, they you know, these were older. I mean, these were around for like, you know, 10,000-20,000 years, right? Like,
No, that's what I mean. Is that it would naturally kind of evolve to that place. Whereas, if we were to make such a transition now, to me that would be like a jump, like a leap. I don't know how we could possibly do that. Like the Plains, one of the Plains Indians tribes, one of the rituals is. As a child at a certain age is put into essentially a circle, and in the circle there are some items in the middle. It was set on fire, and the first item that the child grabs and runs out with is indicative of their chosen gender or path in life. You know, that sort of thinking is I think phenomenal. And we're finally getting there now. We're finally looking at children and saying, okay, you know, we'll tell us who you are, and then we'll take it from there. We'll work on that rather than us forcing our identities onto a child. I think that sort of the exchange of fluidity, I think is something that we're just now catching on to. It seems to me that in a lot of the indigenous American tribes, that was pretty normal, but it took some time, like you said, to get there. So if we're going to make a transition and become this sort of society where, what do you think? Do you think that capitalism has to be eliminated completely?
Well, it has to be evolved. I mean, you know, we need to redesign, for instance. I mean, I know this is, I mean, I wrote a book on this topic that took me 10 years, How Soon Is Now. And it was very hard to get people to focus on the book because, you know, people are very invested in their own lives and like they've got to like pay off their student debt or take care of their kids or whatever. It's hard to think about these like deeper levels of like system change. But I mean, there are great people who've done a lot of this thinking, like Buckminster Fuller is one. He was like a engineer and a systems design scientist in a way. But yeah, like we would have to step back somehow. We have to say, okay, like, yeah, we can't have a growth-based economic system anymore on a planet that's only has very finite resources. I mean, I just read an article today about you know, a lot of California is drying out, you know, like they're having to like, they're bringing, having to, you know, bring bottled water into these communities just to keep them alive, or, you know, drill deeper and deeper. And not even necessarily then is it going to create enough water. So yeah, we have systemic issues that are caused by overdevelopment. And meanwhile, they're still building lots of new housing there, you know, because people want to live in California. It's considered desirable. So we're not using our, you know, capacity for wisdom, you know, for long range forethought. We're just sort of hell-mell, you know, doing whatever comes up because we're thrust into this short-term society where everything is about short-term self-interest.
So democracy, yes, but then the rest we need to work on.
Well, I mean, I'd be curious to try democracy. I mean, I don't think we have one now. I mean, you know, this is like ridiculous. I mean, yes, the Republicans are neo-fascist nationalists supported by oil company money. But the Democrats are technocratic neo-authoritarians supported by Wall Street money, you know? So it's not much of a choice. It's like, oh, you know, we can't vote for Republicans because they're so evil. So you only have one choice left, which is to vote for these other guys. Mm. So they're less evil, but it's like a kind of blackmail. You know, that's not democracy in my eye. I mean, that's a whole nother thing that if you think about technology, like you could have a totally different, basically our government is running on 18th century social technologies. Like we haven't changed things since the Constitution. And I know it's scary and threatening to think of that, but, you know, like things move much faster than they did in 1789. You know, like technology moves faster, the ecological change moves much faster, and we're not able to solve our quandaries with a system where you have these like 4 or 6 year election cycles where the, you know, the representatives are kind of take all this lobbying money and become corrupted by special interests and so on. So you could have more of like a direct democracy system where using something like blockchain, you know, people would be able to vote continuously. You know, like I could say, I'm not an expert in energy, but I like what, you know, Fred, you know, is doing with energy. So I'm going to proxy my vote in local energy systems to Fred. But then if tomorrow I find out that Fred is taking a kickback from, you know, Exxon, I don't have to wait 4 years to get Fred out of office. I immediately take my proxied vote away from Fred and give it to Matilda or something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're just, once again, we're not really using, like we've been using a lot of intelligence when it comes to the technologies, but not in terms of thinking about social technologies and social systems and how we could actually use our, you know, wisdom and forethought to build healthier systems. And if we ever get around to doing that, I think we would look at some of these indigenous cultures as design templates.
Right. And that's kind of where I was in a lengthy way going about trying to say is that, you know, that there's a lot of models there in the indigenous groups that we can follow. Maria Wilson says, how about we get rid of government completely?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, but I mean, I think it's kind of this libertarian kind of idea. But the problem is something else is going to emerge, right? Like whoever has the local, you know, like local militias or something. I mean, unless you really get rid of, I mean, that's why you have to think about these things. And, you know, you have to look at human psychology and incentives and think about, I call myself a mystical anarchist. Like ultimately I'm, you know, an anarchist, right? I believe that we should live in fluidic self-organizing systems that change naturally over time. But I don't think we can just jump to that ideal state yet. So we would have to figure out what would be the transitional path to a better state, you know?
Yeah. And I'm glad that you addressed that because I lean more towards what I'm seeing more and more as like the Northern Scandinavian model, because you make this really good point in, I can't remember. I think it was a Substack post. You discussed how, well, it's really great when the wealthier people donate to a charity and they go, here's $500,000, here's $10,000, here's $1 million. Great. But if there wasn't greed there in the first place, then you wouldn't have that end problem of people who need that money. Can you just talk a little bit about that and how you think that could work?
Right. I was saying that I really don't like the whole construct of charity. Because the idea is that somebody has all this money, which they got doing something uncharitable, And therefore, then they have a guilty conscience. So they're trying to solve the guilty conscience or show off how good they are by doing something charitable. Whereas if they just, you know, did everything, you know, that was good and proper from the beginning, there wouldn't be a question of needing to then have charity, you know?
Yeah. So. Survival of the fittest, which is kind of an absurd take on nature. It's not really the way it is, but it's certainly how capitalists see themselves, right? And you know, I'm generally a fan of capitalism, but it's just that the ecosystem is toxic.
It's interesting that we can't really, like, so many people are still feel this like urge to defend capitalism in some way or other.
Daniel, I can't let it go.
No, but I mean, I think it's nice to, like, I like, you know, like, you know, people subscribe to my Substack, they pay me per month, right? You know, I write a book and people buy it.
Yeah.
That's all cool. But the problem with capitalism is not on that level. It's more this extractive level. I mean, if you look you know, the machinations of Wall Street, how 2008, the subprime mortgage thing, I mean, that's not a bug, that's a feature. I mean, that's how financial capitalism has been working since the 70s when we, you know, kind of took the dollar off of the gold standard. Not that I think we should put that back, but I mean, you know, we see Enron, now we see this crypto crashes. I mean, when you create these abstract financial systems and you put people at the levers of those systems, it tends to lead to aggressive, you know, excessive amounts of greed and self-interest and negative outcomes for everybody else.
Yeah. And so many people who find themselves living in that sort of rat race do, you know, go into the Amazon and seek out, you know, ayahuascaras and try to get grounded, reconnect with whatever it is, that mystical experience that they feel like they're missing. When they do that, sometimes it's really hard to go back into the system. There's that feeling, right, of like, this is absurd. What am I doing? But they're still kind of stuck there because there doesn't seem to be much of a choice.
It depends what level you're at. I mean, I have a friend who created a program for tech CEOs of startups, Entrepreneurial Awakening. So he would take them to Peru and they'd go through 2 weeks of ayahuasca and they would have integrative coaching, you know, for months and months after. And, you know, some of them would realize that what they were doing was really not of benefit to the world. And they would then start a different company or move to a company that they felt like. There was one guy who was, like, he was involved with like a soda company, soft drinks or something. And he was like, no, I don't want to do that anymore. So he started working in more like organic, you know, nutraceuticals, you know, something that he felt was actually more beneficial. So yeah, and I find that happens a lot. Like people who go through these types of experiences, you know, maybe they change their investment strategies. You know, maybe they, you know, need to make a little bit of less money, or maybe they take more of their resources and put them towards something that they think is really, you know, incredible or valuable, you know, or nobody else will do.
The feminine spirit, the serpent vision that people see on ayahuasca. I, for one, you know, being not a monotheistic believer, being an ex-Catholic, I've always had issues with the pronouns. You know, God is a he, and so I, when I hear that, like, there's this feminine, this female spirit, how does one interpret that? Is it literally like a female spirit of another kind, or just like a feminine energy? What is it that the people are actually seeing when they're having those experiences, or for yourself, if you've had a similar experience?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't think it's important to get very attached to that. I mean, I think that's, you know, ayahuasca could appear as masculine, you know, peyote could appear as, but there is something to it. I find, like, I mean, people would say that iboga, for instance, is a more masculine energy. And, you know, mainly when I felt like, I mean, I was back in contact with the iboga spirit either during the ceremonies or in dreams or something, it had a masculine kind of presence. And yeah, there is a sense that ayahuasca has a more kind of, sinuous kind of feminine energy. I've even had visions of, you know, a kind of like a dancing woman who seemed to be like representing the spirit of ayahuasca or whatever. But I don't think you need to take these things like so literal. I mean, I think one of our big problems is being too literal, you know, like being too dualistic. Yeah. And I think that, you know, that should be something that psychedelics help dissolve. Mm. And that's also just, you know, our sort of entrapment in, you know, what you could call like a mental rational consciousness structure.
Yeah. Because I wonder, because let's just say ayahuasca as we know it is relatively new, if we can just speculate for a moment, you know, past, you know, 500 years or so, I don't know. If that's the case, I wonder if the message comes through more consistently as a feminine energy, because the intelligence of that spirit, that the world soul, whatever that is that's coming through, is aware that those of us who are coming and trying to seek a mystical experience are kind of running away from the patriarchy, and that's why people are experiencing this strong feminine presence.
Maybe that doesn't totally, you know, resonate with me, but it's, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, we can always make theories about different things. I mean,
yeah.
My, you know, as I said, kind of like, you know, my direct experiences in these visionary states, you know, does kind of correlate to there being a feminine energy or spirit connected to ayahuasca, and more of a masculine one connected to like iboga and peyote or whatever. And maybe like an intersex, you know, multi-gendered one with the mushrooms, which, you know, as we know, mycelia can have like hundreds of sexes in a way. Mm. But I don't think it's important. I don't think it's valuable to hold on to that or get too obsessed with that or fixated on it. Mm-hmm. What might interest you actually would be, if you want to heal some of your Catholic wound, is the Santo Daime, which has actually been one of my favorite ways to experience ayahuasca, which is a syncretic religion from Brazil that happened when these sort of Catholics who were mestizos, who'd grown up, you know, in the colonial world, went back to the Amazon in the 20s as like rubber tappers or border guards, and became friends with the local indigenous people, drank medicine with them, and sort of began to receive messages that integrated kind of indigenous cosmologies and kind of Christian cosmology. So you'd have like the Virgin Mary would also be the mother of the forest. And actually, I had some of my most profound experiences with Santo Daime. They also have very large, they can have very large containers, like 100 people or 300 people.
Oh, wow.
Everybody wears white or blue and white, like little, like sort of like, you know, kind of like Catholic school outfits. If you're a Frittata, the men and women are separate from each other. So it creates like this energy battery between the masculine and feminine polarity. And also they have a lot of different streams in it. Like, one stream is Ubunda work, which is from like the Brazilian kind of like African stream, which is more about like spirit possession and working with disincarnate spirits and so on. Mm-hmm. It's super fascinating. It's like a really complicated technology of spiritual practices in a way.
Yeah. Do you think there is a parallel between the old folklore myth of elf people and you know, sprites and sort of the insectoid divisions that people have today? Is that fall into the, you know, Jungian archetype? Or are these literally beings?
I've written about that a lot. I wrote a little book called The Occult Control System, where I looked at some stuff about that. And also it's in the 2012 book. Yeah, it does sort of seem that there, you know, like Jacques Vallée, you probably know, made a lot of parallels. Mm-hmm. That there were these, you know, stories that were common in the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, where people would meet the sort of the little people and be taken away by them and have to be careful not to eat their food or whatever. And some of those seem to be replicated in these modern encounters with these gray aliens, insectile aliens, which are such a common like cultural kind of paradigm at this point, archetype. So it does sort of feel like we project, you know, kind of our circumstances onto the other world, and then it sort of takes a form that relates to, you know, our expectations or what we think is possible in a way.
Yeah. How do you just define a mystical experience?
How do I define a mystical experience?
Oh, and by the way, do you have a microphone near you? Because your sound went down a little bit.
No, I don't. I lean forward.
Okay.
I mean, I guess if you have an experience where your sort of sense of ego self is kind of like turned down a little bit, like softened, mm-hmm. and you feel that you have more of a connection with everything around you. Then there's different levels to that. I mean, that there could be, you know, a sort of low level, or, you know, at a very high level, you know, you can feel total dissolution of your ego, self, your subjectivity, and kind of immersion in just the all, in a way, the cosmic void or the cosmic everything, you know. Mm. So yeah, there's a lot of different levels there.
Our relationship to the earth, nature, and focus on ecology, could that, if we improve that that connection collectively, is that the key to moving to whatever that next level is of humanity? Is that the missing link or missing stepping stone?
It's interesting. I mean, I think it's possible. I mean, I feel like we're not going to get anywhere. You know, I don't like this whole, you know, technological singularity transhumanist idea. That is, you know, pulling us, you know, further and further into like the virtual and the artificial. I think that we need to, you know, somehow, you know, make use of the tools, like master technology rather than it sort of controlling us, which is kind of what's happened now. And, you know, particularly, yeah, if we could, you know, re-garden planet Earth and create like a festival garden Earth planets where, mm-hmm. everybody, you know, like, I mean, I'm a, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, we could use the technology to eliminate a lot of the drudgery that people have to do and a lot of the misery, and then more people could enjoy, you know, lifestyles of introspection, creativity, you know. I think that, I mean, that's in How Soon Is Now. I looked a lot at Oscar Wilde's essay called The Soul of Man Under Socialism, where he talked about that. It's like his vision of the future would be one where machines did all the drudgery and people had all the time they needed to love and to create and to enjoy what he called cultivated leisure.
Yeah, I know Terence McKenna brought that up a lot, the idea of the psychedelics being the mystical access for the working man, working person class, you know, because not everyone has time to meditate for, you know, 10 hours a day or, you know, 1 hour a day or whatever it is. And it's the only way for a lot of people to access that experience. But we have, if we change society, then maybe we can get there, right? Where people can have that. And then the next question would be, is it for everybody? Does everybody need it? Should everybody try, you know, a psychedelic, in your opinion?
I mean, I'm not even a big proponent of psychedelics, strangely enough. I don't think everybody should do whatever they want to do. I mean, if you feel called to try psychedelics, you can do that. Yeah. But for another person, it could be like meditating or just mm-hmm. like hanging out with their friends or whatever. I mean, you know, I think I'm not trying to like create some prescription for people. Right. You know,
or drink coffee like I do.
I'm a big coffee drinker. But I mean, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, and then like if you look at all the different indigenous cultures, they do it very differently. Like, you know, some of them, you know, everybody drinks medicine, you know, sometimes they call ayahuasca medicine. Or peyotes, you know, some cultures it's just, you know, the shaman who actually drinks it for the patient and then uses it to cure. You know, then you have like, I mean, I'm super interested in like Indo-Tibetan Buddhism and mm-hmm. you know, these cultures which have these like really profound esoteric practices, and you know, they're way more advanced than we'll ever be, I think. You know, it will take us a long time to get there. Mm-hmm. They don't need any substances, you know, they just use meditative practices to, you know, get into altered states of consciousness and access, you know, things that we don't even understand yet.
You know? Right. Well, there you go. I mean, if we had a society where we didn't have to do the drudge work, that could be another way for people to access mystical experiences. But I think for many, see, the Catholic Church was interesting, right? Because it was designed, the stained glass windows, the frankincense and myrrh, it was designed to kind of give you a transportive experience. So when you go in there, you're going to the sacred space, which, you know, I did find enchanting as a child and still do to a degree. But it was really the priest that was the one that had the access to the mystical. And if you can leave us with a thought on the mystical, based on all of your experiences, whatever you want, what would it be?
A thought on the mystical. I don't know how to answer that question. I do terrible. I do much better with more directed questions. Whenever I ask me for a more vague question like that, I can never really answer it and sum it up much.
Let me help you out. Is the mystical something that is essential? The mystical experience that everyone deserves to have.
I mean, I think anybody could do what they want, but I mean, my perspective is that the evolution of human civilization mm-hmm. is going to be in the direction of the exploration of consciousness as mm-hmm. the next frontier, and that actually it's not outer space is not as interesting as inner space, and we actually have huge realms of potentiality within mind body states, different forms of state specific knowledge, different accesses to different dimensions and realities and so on, and we're not even 0.1% in that exploration. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's extremely exciting because it's a little bit of the materialist worldview has been to sort of foreclose reality really quickly and be like, we're almost done with what we can know, and now it's just about plugging into the matrix or whatever. I mean, I don't really think that way at all. I think that the exploration of consciousness, mystical states, transpersonal states, shamanic states, occult realities, there's so much there for us to get into that could keep us busy for many thousands of years. And we just have to get beyond this stupid primate phase that we're in now of competition and domination and, exploitative capitalism.
And does love fall in there somewhere?
Love definitely falls all over the place.
we talk about that, right? But what about the ayahuascaros? Do they use that word or some version of it?
Yeah, it's just you can't really generalize because we have a Western way of handling things, mm-hmm. and we sometimes go in and appropriate and try to understand things that are different. I mean, right. Yeah. For ayahuasca was used in a lot of indigenous cultures, for power. For hunting magic or for even killing your opponent on the astral plane. I mean, they were living in a totally different, reality kind of framework than we are. So I think, for some of the cultures like the Sequoia who I worked with, or now the Santo Daime. Yeah. I mean, love, connection with the cosmos, peace. I mean, that's definitely, part, but it's not intrinsic. As I said, these medicines are just tools and you can do a lot of different things with them. They can, be used for sorcery or they can be used for bodhicitta, loving mm-hmm. compassion, so the choice is in our hands in a way.
All right. Everyone, please check out danielpinchbeck.substack.com and please check out his books. He's a fantastic author. He packs in a lot of thoughtful ideas and makes it very digestible and easy to read.
Yeah.
Daniel, thank you so much.
If anybody wants to DM me on Twitter, it's just my mm-hmm. name on Twitter, I'll give them a 3-month free subscription to the newsletter so they can read the full pieces.
Okay. There you go. All right. Thanks, Daniel.
Alan, it was great to chat.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have a great time.
You too. Thank you. All right. And thank you everybody for joining us tonight. I really appreciate your support. If you enjoyed the show, please comment down below, like, and subscribe as usual on the Mystic Lounge YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Mystic Lounge. And if you are an iTunes user, please go to iTunes and give a rating and a review there. I'd really appreciate it. All right. Until next time, peace and love, and live in the mystery, everyone.